Chapter 31, Fever Season.
So I'll be sailing on, I'm gone, I'll be sailing on, I'm going into the sun, I'll be sailing on, I'm gone, I'll be sailing.
Anakin woke up wrapped in the Force and about 6 too many blankets, nearly choking on Padme's hair. On their own, those were all familiar sensations. Put together, he untangled himself carefully from Padme's hair first, which had come free of the braids it had been in and sprung up in a wild cloud of curls. Padme made a sound of sleepy distraction in the back of her throat. Anakin felt the flicker of her wakefulness in the Force and leaned down to whisper, "It's fine, go back to sleep," in her ear. He kissed her bare shoulder before turning his attention to the problem of the blankets. The blankets were more troublesome. Obi-Wan, who hated being cold, had cocooned himself in them and somehow managed to do so in such a way that they were tightly knotted around Anakin's legs and his right arm. Anakin prodded at his shoulder with his free hand and hissed, "Obi-Wan, seriously?" Obi-Wan responded with an indistinct sound, still entirely asleep, and rolled over so that Anakin had a little more slack to work himself free. He had to climb over Obi-Wan to get out of the bed, since Obi-Wan had taken the side closest to the door. Somehow he managed not to fall over in the process, though it was a near thing, and he had to catch the nightstand to steady himself. Both their lightsabers were there, in easy reach. Anakin realized abruptly that it was the first time since they had gotten back that he had seen Obi-Wan sleep without his lightsaber either in hand or under his pillow. He pulled on the first pair of pants he found, which turned out to be Obi-Wan's, at least judging from the cool air around his ankles, and ducked into the refresher, sliding the door silently shut behind him. While he was washing his hands, he found himself staring at the mirror, searching his own face for... he didn't know what he was looking for. He didn't look any different, unless you counted the hickey on his neck. Anakin rubbed at it, self-conscious, despite the fact that there was no one else in the small room with him. He had a pretty vivid memory of Obi-Wan's teeth against his skin, Padme's blunt nails scraping down his back. "Force help you, Skywalker. You slept with your best friend and watched him sleep with your wife, and you liked it." Anakin tipped his head forward against the mirror, gripping either side of the sink as he watched his breath fog the glass. After a moment, he looked up again, studying his own reflection. Mild blue eyes looked back at him. Blue, not Sith yellow. Vader wouldn't have done that. Vader might have wanted it. Anakin had no idea what Vader had wanted, but he wouldn't have done that. Anakin scrubbed a hand over his face, then went back into the bedroom to find his own clothes, moving as quietly as possible so that he didn't wake either Obi-Wan or Padme. He dressed quickly, barefoot on the thick carpet as he slipped out of the bedroom and into the short corridor that led to the sitting room. It was still dark, before the late dawn of winter, and the only light that filtered into the sitting room was a little moonlight from the waning crescent moon. It was enough to see by, for a Jedi at least. And Anakin didn't bother turning the overhead lights on as he crossed to the couch. This nearly undid him when he caught one foot on a pile of fabric and nearly tripped, biting his lip on his automatic curse before he steadied himself and looked to see what it was. It was Padme's clothes. Anakin knelt down to gather them up, meaning to put them out of the way so no one else would make the same mistake he had. A whisper in the Force warned him just before his hand connected. Anakin drew his hand back, wary, then reached out more gingerly to flip back the folds of fabric until he found what it was. When he did, he sat back on his heels, staring at it, feeling the fluctuations in the Force. That was how Obi-Wan found him later, just as the sun began to rise. He laid a hand on Anakin's shoulder. Anakin leaned back automatically, letting his head rest against Obi-Wan's thigh.
"What is it?"
Obi-Wan asked, though he must have been able to sense it too. Anakin didn't know how he could have missed it, even from the bedroom. The strange black metal swallowed up all the light of Alderaan's magnificent sunrise, the red gems of the eyes seeming to capture it and glow like the eyes of a living being. Anakin could feel the damn thing and the force, and it made him want to run as far and as fast as he could in the opposite direction, to shoot it into a sun or drop it into a black hole.
"It's the Ouroboros,"
he told Obi-Wan.
"It's live again."
The higher-ranking Naboo military officers who had been taken prisoner were being kept in the detention center in what was left of the Thede City RNSF base. Stoss hadn't been able to find out where the lower-ranking ones were being held, but at the moment, that didn't particularly matter. It wasn't them that she wanted to talk to. The clone troopers on guard let her pass without question. Stoss walked down the narrow corridor, glancing to either side at the cells and their closed doors or race-shielded entrances. She recognized a few of the occupants from Republic Intelligence's files in the RNSF, but most were strangers to her. Many of the officers that had been on-world or in-system at the time of the attack had been killed in the fighting. A handful had escaped. Only a few had been captured. Commodore Yathan de Loca was in one of the last cells in the corridor, the only one with ray shields instead of closed doors. The others must be empty. She wasn't shock-cuffed anymore, but she was still wearing the remains of her scorched and battered uniform, minus the jacket, which was neatly folded on the narrow cot. She straightened up from the sit-ups she had been doing as Stoss stopped in front of the ray shield.
"Master Jedi?"
"Commodore Loca."
Stoss clasped her hands behind her back, studying the other woman. Loca got slowly to her feet, brushing a few wisps of green hair out of her face. She was a small woman, smaller than Stoss, and the bruises on her face made her look much younger than she actually was. If Stoss remembered correctly, Loca was only a few years older than the Queen of Naboo. They were supposed to be friends. Stoss was counting on that piece of intelligence being fact.
"Can I do something for you, Master Jedi?" Loca said after a moment, stepping close to the ray shield.
"I'm afraid my options at the moment are severely limited." She spread her hands slightly, indicating the cell. "I'm General Stoss Alley," Stoss said. "I want you to see something." She took a miniature holoprojector out of one of her belt pouches and let it rest on her palm, flicking the controls with her thumb. There was some static in the image, but not so much that the figures in it were indistinguishable. The first was a young woman with blonde hair knotted up at the back of her head, an ELG-3A blaster pistol in one hand. The second was a woman in a naval officer's uniform and an admiral's rank pins on her collar. Republic Intelligence had identified the first as Irte Katen, one of Queen Amidala's handmaidens, and the second as Admiral Emil Agathon, the commander of the home fleet. Loca crossed her arms over her chest, watching the short hologram in silence. When it had shut off, she said,
"What is this?"
"You were present at the end, I'm sure you know," Stoss said. "We intercepted and decoded this transmission during the Battle of Naboo, shortly before 9 ships from the home fleet turned tail and ran." Loca's mouth tightened. "They weren't running. They had orders."
"From one of the Queen's handmaidens, yes," Stoss agreed.
"It still looks very much like running to me. They could have stayed and fought, defended and booed to the very last man or woman, the way you did." "My ships volunteered as a forlorn hope, Jedi."
"Your ships were damaged. You didn't have the option to jump to hyperspace the way Admiral Agathon and the others did.
That's not volunteering, Commodore. That's being left behind. And hundreds of your people died for it."
"Thousands of people died because the Republic couldn't leave well enough alone," Loca said.
She stabbed a finger in the direction of the floor.
"Thousands are dying now because you Jedi, who call yourselves peacekeepers, won't keep the peace.
You'd rather make war on my people.
Stas rubbed her thumb over the side of the holoprojector. You had a reason to believe that there was still something worth defending, Commodore.
Yes, Master Jedi. It's called faith. Perhaps you've heard of it.
No, you had a concrete reason. Something Lady Irte said told you that there was something worth fighting for. That was enough for Admiral Agathon to abandon her post.
Loka flicked her gaze at Stas, her expression inscrutable.
Fever season, Stas quoted, and the floodwaters are rising. That's what Admiral Agathon told you, and that was enough for you to volunteer your ships without so much as a word of protest to cover the retreat of the rest of the home fleet. One of those phrases told you to run. I think it was the second one.
Loka tipped her head slightly to one side in something that might have been acknowledgement.
Not hard to guess. Irte gave Emil the whole message, and the word run actually is in it. So much for the vaunted foresight of the Jedi.
Stas leaned forward and repeated, enunciating clearly. Fever season. Loka leaned back from her, her neck cracking audibly as she rolled her head from side to side.
Why do you care?
Because you told Emil Agathon to give the Queen your regards, Stas said. Something in that message told you that Queen Amidala was still alive and that she wasn't on Naboo when the attack occurred. When Admiral Tarkin took you to see Sabela Doyen's body, you were shocked by how she was killed, but you weren't surprised to see her. You already knew that she wasn't the Queen. Her own mother wouldn't have been able to tell them apart, but you... You didn't even have to look at her to know that wasn't Queen Amidala lying on that slab.
Are you getting at something, Master Jedi?
Yes, Stas said. Naboo has already fallen. Chancellor Dooku is going to make the announcement to the galaxy soon. You have nothing left to protect, Commodore Loka. She hesitated for a moment, glancing down the corridor toward the clone troopers near the doors, then said, I know that Queen Amidala is alive, and that she was off-world when the invasion occurred. I know because one of her handmaidens told me.
Loka jerked in surprise, though she covered the gesture up well.
Do you expect me to believe that?
It's the truth. Moltier Aleri saw what happened in the throne room. I spoke to her there.
I'm betting that she was the one who told Irte Katen to give the home fleet that order, because we know that there were still Naboo transmissions going in and out of the palace even after the attack began.
Loka blinked once, slowly. If you had spoken to Motie, then she would be dead, or you would.
Stas shook her head.
You misjudge me, Commodore.
Loka crossed her arms over her chest, glancing aside.
Even if I do believe you, Master Jedi... That doesn't mean anything. You haven't asked me any questions yet, not really.
Stas took a deep breath, reaching into the Force for serenity. We haven't found Motier, Irte, or any of the members of Obi-Wan Kenobi's Special Operations Unit. I think they're still in the city. I want you to take me to them.
No.
Then tell me how to get in touch with them. You were with the Queen during the Siege of Theed 12 years ago. You're the second highest-ranking naval officer in the system. The highest-ranking now that Admiral Agathon has fled. I know that Amidala had plans in place for what to do if Naboo was ever attacked again, if the planet fell. You know them. And you know where her people would have gone.
I'm a sailor, Master Jedi. I don't know anything that goes on dirtside.
There. Stas couldn't always feel a lie in the Force, but this time she was certain of it. She felt herself smile, sensing Commodore Loka's flicker of sudden uncertainty at the expression.
You know this. If you think I'm going to turn my people over to you, you are very wrong, Jedi, Loka said.
I don't want your people, Stas said. I want to talk to Motier Aleri.
Why?
She knows why.
I don't. Loka said, raising her chin.
Why should I believe anything you say, Jedi? You invaded my planet, killed my people. I am telling the truth. are you, Master Allie?
Stas whirled, her lightsaber jumping from her belt to her hand, more from instinct than conscious thought, as the doors of the cells on either side of Locus slid open, revealing Admiral Tarkin and a dozen clone troopers.
Tarkin smiled slightly. Now, Master Allie, put your lightsaber down, and we will discuss treason.
The day had dawned clear and cold, making Quinlan glad of his fur-lined winter cloak as they waited on the lowered ramp of the Scorpion. Obi-Wan, of course, looked like he had walked out of the pages of one of Naboo's fashion magazines, though the fact that he was fiddling with his gloves and looking irritated ruined the figure that he cut. Luminara's only concession to the weather was a heavy Naboo-style cloak. She didn't have her own winter gear with her, of course, and Mary Ellen's didn't feel the cold much anyway. Kit and Eeth were still in the ship, where it was warm. Lucky them. Quinlan had flown the Scorpion over to one of Aldera City's smaller spaceports, the kind of port where he could rent a bay for an hour or two and no one would look at him askance. Ayla was supposed to meet them there. She was late, and he was worrying.
"Breathe, Quinn," Obi-Wan said without looking at him. "She'll be here."
"I know that," Quinlan snapped, and caught sight of Obi-Wan's sardonic expression out of the corner of his eye. Obi-Wan and Luminara exchanged a look that had already been old when they were all 12, and Quinlan stared at the door to the hangar bay, permanently wedged half open, and tried not to shiver too badly. Khafu, his homeworld, was a warm planet, or at least warmer than Alderaan, anyway. And Quinlan had always hated this kind of weather with every fiber of his jungle-bred being.
Maybe she'll have changed her mind, he thought hopefully.
Which would still land them with 2 Jedi Knights to be disposed of, but in that scenario, they could just revert to Plan Arek and have the Alderaanians drop Kit and Eeth off at the nearest neutral world.
He was pretty sure that Ayla wouldn't change her mind, though.
Quinlan clasped his gloved hands together beneath his chin and rested his elbows on his knees, trying not to jostle them and repeatedly punch himself in the jaw. The three of them sat in silence for a few minutes. Then Obi-Wan said abruptly, "Quinn, if you want to go with her, I'm not going to stop you." Quinlan swung around to stare at him.
"Seriously? All this, and you're just going to let me go with a whatever you want, Quinn?"
Obi-Wan spread his hands.
"I wasn't the one who brought you here, Quinlan. If you want to leave, I'm not going to be the one to keep you."
Quinlan shut his eyes.
"I don't want to go back," he said, but the words came with a pang. He was a Jedi Knight. The Order was his entire life. But some things aren't forgivable.
"You're not getting rid of me that easily, Obi-Wan."
After a moment, Obi-Wan said, "I just want you to know you have options."
Quinlan rubbed a hand over his face.
"Trust me, I'm aware."
He fumbled with his gloves just for something to do, then added, "Not going to give Luminara that talk?"
"We've already discussed it,"
Luminara said. She leaned forward and rested a slim gloved hand on his shoulder.
"You must do what you think is right, of course."
"Yeah, that's why I'm here."
Quinlan rubbed at his forehead, resisting the urge to say something like,
"Easy for you to say. Your better one's here and your master's been dead for years. Nothing for you to worry about."
He looked up as he sensed Ayla in the Force, just before she walked through the doors. She had one hand beneath the long fall of her coat, undoubtedly resting on the hilt of her lightsaber, and a small bag slung over her opposite shoulder. Quinlan saw her tense as she realized that he wasn't alone. He straightened up. Luminara started to stand too, then stopped as Obi-Wan put a restraining hand on her arm.
"Master Quinn," Ayla said cautiously.
Quinlan raised his hands so that she could see that they were empty.
"This isn't a trap, Ayla."
Ayla hesitated for a moment more, then took her hand out from inside her coat. "I'm sorry, Quinlan," she said. "I didn't think it was. I just didn't know. These are strange times." "Yeah, I know." Behind him, he felt Obi-Wan finally stand, Luminara a beat behind him. "Master Sakura," Obi-Wan said. "It's good to see you again." Ayla was silent for a few seconds, then said, "I could wish for different circumstances, Master Kenobi." She nodded to Luminara. "It's good to see you alive and whole, Master Unduli." Luminara inclined her head slightly. "It's good to be both." The four of them stood in awkward silence, Obi-Wan and Luminara still on the Scorp Island's ramp. At last, Ayla said, "The Padawans?" "They're back at the palace," Quinlan said. "Eth and Kit are inside." Ayla nodded a little, then said in a rush, "Mr. Quinn, do not do this. Please." She stepped forward to rest her hand on his arm, her expression distressed. "You must not do this." Quinlan swallowed, covering her hand with his own. "I have to, Ayla." "No, you don't. You think you have to." She dropped her bag by her feet and gripped both his hands with hers. "Why are you doing this?" Quinlan closed his fingers around hers. She turned her face up to him, her brown eyes huge and horrified. "I can't trust the Council, Ayla. And if I can't trust the Council, then I can't trust the Order, and I don't know if I can trust myself." "I trust you," Ayla protested. "Whatever happens, Quinlan, I trust you. I'll stand by you. In anything but this. I know you believe in me, Ayla, and I'm grateful for that. But this isn't about us. I can't stay there any longer. Not now." Even through the gloves both of them were wearing, her grip was like Durasteel. "The Jedi Order is your life," she said. "You can't just throw it away like this. Master Quinn, you are making a mistake." Quinlan tried to meet her eyes and found that he couldn't, turning his head aside instead. He caught sight of Obi-Wan's sympathetic expression out of the corner of his eye and looked away from him back at Ayla. "Maybe," he told her, "but it's my mistake to make. I have to find that out on my own, without the Council and without the Order. I need to know if I can still be a Jedi without them." Her voice caught in a sob. "Master, if you do this, there may be no coming back." "I know," Quinlan said. "Believe me, I know." He squeezed her hands. "Ayla, we will see each other again, I promise you."
"On opposite sides of a battlefield?"
"Maybe. I hope not."
"Master Quinlan, please."
He shook his head and saw Ayla close her eyes, shuddering all over. After a moment, she opened them again, pulling her hands free from his. She stood still for a moment, like she didn't know what to do with herself. "You are making a mistake, Quinlan," she repeated. She looked around at Luminara and Obi-Wan and added, "You are all making a terrible mistake." "My choice was made years ago," Obi-Wan said softly. Luminara just looked down, catching her lower lip briefly between her teeth. Ayla pressed her hands to her mouth. Quinlan could feel her struggling for calm, though he hardly needed the force to tell how upset she was. "You could come," he said, but she shook her head. "You know I can't do that, Quinlan." She dropped her hands, breathing hard. After a moment, she stooped to pick up her fallen bag. Quinlan stopped her with a hand on her shoulder. As she looked back at him, her mouth trembling, he pulled her into a hard hug. Her hands closed into fists against his back. She pressed her cheek against his shoulder, and Quinlan held on for what felt like far too short a time before he finally released her. Ayla swiped a hand beneath her eyes as she stepped back. "I'm sorry, Quinn," she said. "I'm so sorry."
"So am I."
It was all Quinlan could do not to go after her. All he could do was stand still, his hands clenched into fists. Moving like an old woman, slow and jerky, Ayla picked up her bag, nodded to Luminara and Obi-Wan, and went up the ramp into the Scorpion. Quinlan heard her greet Kit and Eeth before she raised the ramp. The sound of the ship's engines was a dull roar, the backwash of hot air warming the landing bay negligibly. Obi-Wan and Luminara stepped back, but Quinlan stayed where he was, his head tipped back to watch as the Scorpion rose up off the pad. He saw Ayla in the pilot's seat, press her palm briefly against the transparisteel of the viewport before the upper doors of the hangar ground open and the ship darted upward. He stared up at it until it was long out of sight. When he finally looked down, it was to feel tears on his cheeks. Irritated, Quinlan swiped at them, hoping that the others hadn't seen. Obi-Wan looped an arm around his neck and pulled him into a rough embrace. Luminara, on his other side, wrapped an arm around his waist. "Come on," Obi-Wan said, his voice gentler than Quinlan would have thought to give him credit for. "We've got work to do." "Admiral?" Stas said, blank shock overlaying everything else in her mind. She stared at the clone troopers, trying to make sense out of their appearance here.
"Put your lightsaber down, Master Ali, and put your hands up," Tarkin repeated. "You are under arrest for treason and espionage."
"What?"
Behind her, Commodore Loka laughed, though it was a low, half-disbelieving sound.
"You must be joking," she said. "This one!"
"I'm not a spy," Stas said, stunned by the accusation. "I'm a knight of the Republic."
"You are a spy and a traitor who has just admitted to conspiring with the enemy. Put your lightsaber down, woman."
At his gesture, two clones stepped forward, one of them reaching for Stas's arms. Stas meant to let them, because this would be sorted out. The Council would never allow this. Then the first clone gripped her arm hard enough to hurt, and instinct and training took over. Stas flung him sideways, back into the ray shield, Commodore Loka flinching back as he hit it, and slammed a high kick into the other clone's jaw. Her lightsaber flashed into existence as someone fired instinctively, and she deflected the bolt into the floor, bringing the lightsaber back around in front of her in a guard position.
"That wasn't a good idea," she said.
Tarkin had gone narrow-eyed, his attention intent on her.
"And that was unwise, Master Ali. I will give you one more chance. Put your lightsaber down, put your hands up, and come with us, or I cannot speak for the consequences of your actions."
"Admiral," Stas said, "whatever you think you heard, it was a mistake. My loyalty is to the Republic, to the Jedi Order. I'm no more a traitor than you are."
"A claim that remains to be proven."
He gave the burning green blade of her lightsaber a dismissive look.
"Your weapon, Master Ali."
Stas hesitated, then deactivated her lightsaber.
"Put it down on the floor and kick it towards me."
Every instinct Stas had, all her years of training and field experience, told her not to do anything of the sort. But she knelt anyway to set her lightsaber hilt down on the ferrocrete floor, then straightened up to nudge it into Tarkin's direction with the toe of her left boot. One of the clone troopers leaned over to pick it up and hand it to Tarkin, who turned it over in his hands. His expression was satisfied.
"A wise move, Master Jedi."
He jerked his chin at the clones.
"Take her."
"This is a mistake," Stas said, gritting her teeth and letting herself be jerked around, her cheek pressed to the wall beside the humming ray shield as one clone pulled her hands behind her back and snapped a pair of shock cuffs onto her wrists. Another was checking the clone she had thrown into the ray shield, which fortunately was set to stun and not to kill. She was aware of Commodore Loka's curious gaze from inside the cell, the quick calculation in the other woman's eyes.
Perhaps, Tarkin said. The evidence, however, is overwhelming.
Stas was turned around to face him.
There is no evidence, she said.
Really, Master Ali? I have a hologram of you confessing to allowing an enemy of the state to escape capture, and you say that there is no evidence. I suppose that you were not the being who accessed the palace computer logs, either.
Stas opened her mouth to reply, then stopped, realizing that she couldn't deny it.
That is what I thought, Tarkin said.
He turned away, her lightsaber still held in his hand.
Bring her. I think that the Supreme Chancellor will be very interested in this.
The Jedi Council will not be pleased by this effrontery, Admiral, Stas said coldly. But she let the clone trooper holding her arm propel her forward, with one hand between her shoulder blades. She could sense the man's wariness. All of them. They had seen what she had done to the first two clones, and by now they were well aware of what a Jedi could do in battle.
Stupid, 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 you shouldn't have overreacted.
Jedi, Commodore Loka called suddenly, before Stas had taken more than a few steps down the corridor. At Tarkin's gesture, the clones stopped, and Stas turned to look at her. Loka was as close to the ray shield as she could get, her small hands clenched into fists at her sides. She met Stas's eyes with her own green ones, and said clearly, "If you let me out, I'll take you to Queen Amidala and Captain Kenobi. I think you and Her Royal Highness have a lot to discuss." Stas had enough time to think, "You just signed my death warrant," before Tarkin snapped, "Bring her now." "Blast it," Stas whispered. But she needed the information too badly to chance the whims of the Admiralty. She knew that the Council had only kept hold of Obi-Wan Kenobi because he had been in Jedi custody at the time, but if the Admiral went head-to-head with the Council over her, then it could be weeks. Months, even. She remembered the drawn-out infighting between the Senate and the Order from the early days of her knighthood, when Palpatine had still been Supreme Chancellor. And she needed to know now. Force help her. Let the Council still listen to her after this. The clone trooper holding her tried to shove her forward again, and Stas slammed herself sideways, knocking him into the man beside him. She stumbled for half a moment, then caught her balance and swung a roundhouse kick up into the clone reaching for her, sending him careening amongst his fellows. Stas leapt straight up, tucking her legs under herself as she pulled her cuffed arms forward beneath her feet to have her hands in front of her. She slammed an elbow into the neck of another clone, then caught at his helmeted chin and jerked him around, using him as a counterbalance as she flung herself into another kick, her body briefly parallel to the ground before she jerked the clone down and landed in a crouch.
"Unwise, Master Ali," Tarkin told her,
then jerked in surprise as Stas held her hands out for her lightsaber. He tried to hang on, but the hilt slipped out of his hands and slapped into her palm. Stas ignited the blade through her shock cuffs, already moving. The blade cut cleanly through the barrels of the blasters the clones were leveling at her, then Stas deactivated it and flung her free hand out, reaching for the threads of the Force to throw them back, bowling Tarkin over as they struck him.
"Let me out!"
Loka said urgently, slamming a fist into the wall beside the ray shield. Stas didn't have the keycard for the cell, but she shoved the Force through it, raw power burning out the mechanisms as the shield failed and died. Loka ducked out immediately, crouching down to snatch up one of the clones' blasters. The way down the corridor was blocked by the groaning bodies of the clones.
"Damn you and damn Queen Amidala," Stas told Loka,
reigniting her lightsaber as she turned to the blank wall at the end of the corridor. She plunged the blade in nearly to the hilt, half her attention on the men behind her as she carved a circle out of the wall, then lifted it out of the way with a Force.
"Have some respect, Master Jedi," Loka said.
"You had better be telling the truth," Stas said, motioning her through the hole. It led out to a courtyard, only slightly scorched from the bombing, thank the Force, and not a room full of more clones. She followed Loka through, keeping a wary eye on the corridor as Admiral Tarkin began to fight his way out from beneath the clones.
"And you'd better trust me, Master Jedi. You're out of options now."
Loka flashed her a faint grin, her teeth white in the moonlight. "This way." They had gone barely a dozen paces when alarms began to blare across the base. Stas swore again, fluently and viciously, and looked at Loka. Can you run?
My legs are fine, Loka said.
Then run. Loka knew the RNSF base better than Stas did, and she led them unerringly through the maze of buildings, muttering to herself whenever she ran into a section that had been damaged in either the Trade Federation bombing or the Republic invasion. Stas kept her lightsaber in her hand, the blade deactivated but her finger close to the trigger, and followed her through. More than once, she grabbed Loka by the shoulder, once by her injured shoulder, making the other woman hiss in pain, and pulled her out of the way of oncoming clone troopers. They were moving in squadrons through the base, obviously searching for them. Stas noted with clinical detachment that there weren't any Jedi among them. Tarkin must think that they might have divided loyalties.
Then he doesn't know the Jedi very well.
They're using the main gates? Loka asked her, and Stas nodded. Let's hope they haven't... blessed. They ducked down behind a half-burnt hedge as half a dozen clone troopers ran past. In a whisper, Loka said, I was stationed here when I used to liaise with the RNSFC. There's another exit near the waterfall side. It's left over from when this used to be part of the palace. Hopefully your people haven't found it yet. They stepped cautiously out from behind the hedge after Stas was sure that the clone troopers had gone, and ran across the lawn, which had long since been trodden into mud. If Loka hadn't told her that the entrance was there, Stas wouldn't have seen it. It was half concealed behind a fall of cut vines, but even after they cleared those away, it didn't look like anything so much as another piece of the wall. Loka rubbed at the stone with a torn sleeve, frowning to herself, then slid her fingernails beneath the edge of a brick and whispered, Come on, come on. The cover of the control panel swung open, caked with dirt and ash. Loka let out a sigh of relief and tapped a code into the keypad, watching as the door in the wall slid open with a grinding sound that made them both wince. Outside, Stas could see a narrow alley that looked and felt unoccupied. Loka closed the cover over the keypad as Stas stepped through, then followed her out. She started to look around for the control panel on this side before Stas waved the door closed.
Handy, Loka admitted.
Stas glanced back at the base behind them. It was lit up as if for a festival, alarms blaring loudly enough to make her wince. As she watched, two gunships rose up, their searchlights moving over the ground beneath them. They joined the half-dozen or so already on patrol over the city. Loka looked up at them, her lip curling back in a sneer.
Damn you, she said.
The invasion wasn't my idea. You were still a part of it. She kept the blaster held against the side of her leg as they moved down the alley. You're right. Her Highness and Captain Kenobi aren't on world, and with the holonet down, there's no way to get a hold of them.
Stas stared at her.
So you said that just to ruin my life?
Loka shrugged.
Acting on it was your choice, Master Jedi. I had to take the chance.
She flicked her gaze up at the searching gunships again, then added,
Her Royal Highness had contingency plans in place in case of another invasion. If her handmaidens or any of her other people survived, then yes, I know where they would have gone.
Whether or not they're still there is the will of the Force, Stas said through teeth that were clenched so tightly her jaw ached.
The words should have helped, but instead they just felt hollow.
Is this how Obi-Wan felt when he broke his vows?
Except Obi-Wan had broken his vows for himself. Stas had done it for the Order, for the Republic. It wasn't anything like the same thing.
She closed her fist on her lightsaber hilt.
Let's go.
When they walked into the ballroom where the Queen's reception was being held, Padme almost stopped dead. Only experience and instinct kept her moving, matching her stride to Lydia's and Rabe's with the Queen and Captain Kenobi in front of them. For some reason, she hadn't thought that there would be so many delegates here. It was a shock to walk into the room and see so many people, hundreds of representatives from hundreds of worlds. Queen Amidala had only had the opportunity to meet personally with a few dozen.
Well, it is called the Delegation of 2000, I suppose they didn't choose the number out of a hat.
The only worlds that had been able to send delegates had been those between the Deep Core and the Expansion Region.
those further out had been too far away to contact with the Holonet down in the time they had. Padme let her gaze flick over the nearest beings, searching for faces that she recognized, and tried not to wince as she realized how many of them there were. Her politics and Queen Amidala's weren't terribly different when it came down to it. The Queen simply took a far more aggressive approach to achieving her goals. Bail Organa and Mon Mothma were already here. Padme had seen yesterday a number of the other worlds that had chosen to side with them. It was natural that many of them would be her own allies in the Senate. Without moving her lips, her voice so low that Padme could barely hear her, Rabe said, "What is it? You're upset." Padme flicked a glance at her. Rabe wasn't looking at her, her gaze moving ceaselessly around the room, evaluating it for threats like there weren't several dozen Alderaanian guards and 6 Jedi doing the same thing. "So many," she said. Her voice wasn't as soft as Rabe's, but under the general murmur of conversation in the ballroom, it would be nearly impossible to overhear. "This isn't the half of it, darling," Lydia said, turning her head a little so that she could study Padme from under the protruding bill of her hood. They hadn't spoken much over the past few days. Padme still wasn't entirely certain that she knew what Lydia thought of her or her presence here. Padme herself wasn't entirely certain what she thought of Lydia. She wasn't a handmaiden in her own universe, and Padme had never heard of her before. She had no model on which to base a comparison, and for some reason that bothered her, even though that was hardly fair to Lydia. "Yes," Padme said slowly. "I'm starting to realize that." Even with several hundred delegates here, this was only a fraction of the delegation worlds. Padme knew that there were thousands of others besides them that had already seceded and joined either the Confederacy or the Alliance of Sovereign Systems. As far as she had been able to determine, the number of worlds to do so was roughly the same as that of the Separatist worlds in her own universe. It was only the worlds themselves that differed. "This isn't your universe. These aren't your friends." None of Padme's friends would ever be party to something like this. Except Mina Bonteri had taken Onderon over to the Confederacy. She had been wrong about Dooku, but Padme was clear-headed enough to understand that many of the Separatists weren't evil, the way Dooku and his Trade Federation cronies were. Mina Bonteri hadn't been the only Separatist that Padme had known personally before the war, just the one she had been closest to. Many of them had had legitimate reasons to believe that the Confederacy would be better for them than the Galactic Republic. They had been wrong, but that was through no fault of their own. Dooku had been very charismatic, when he had wanted to be. Padme had always wondered why Palpatine hadn't fought harder to keep them in the Republic, or even to bring them back into the fold. Onderon was a rare exception, and that operation had been conducted entirely without the knowledge of the Senate or the Executive Office. But she knew now. "Not that that means anything here. Palpatine's nowhere in sight." She let her gaze move across the room, trailing the Queen's progress through the crowd. Amidala moved from one small cluster of delegates to the next, addressing each by name, Rabe usually stepping up to whisper it in her ear just before Amidala spoke, exchanging a few soothing words meant to undercut their anxieties. Captain Kenobi was at her elbow, smiling the same polite smile that Obi-Wan had used when he was suddenly faced with more than 2 or 3 politicians. Padme had gotten the impression that he didn't care for politics any more than Obi-Wan did, though he was better at concealing it. She supposed that he had had more opportunity to learn how, and more reason to do so. Delegates were gathering in small groups that seemed to be constantly shifting, speaking with each other, with the Organas and Mon Mothma, with Satine Kryes, with the Jedi. Both Master Vos and Master Luminara had done exactly what Queen Amidala had meant them to, and had attracted hangers-on, many of whom were, Padme overheard when the Queen's entourage passed close to Master Unduli, urgently asking the same two questions over and over again. Are the Jedi choosing sides now? And what does that mean for the galaxy? Luminara, she supposed, was also being repeatedly asked about the faked execution. Movement along the balcony ringing the ballroom caught her eye. Padme looked up as inconspicuously as she could. The balcony itself was blurred to her eyes by a privacy barrier, but behind it she could see the dark shapes of Alderaanian royal guards walking their circuits, and a pair of figures standing beside each other that were almost certainly Obi-Wan and Anakin, judging by the height difference and the shapes that Padme could make out. The taller one, maybe catching sight of her sudden attention, made a blurred-looking salute in her direction. Padme smiled to herself, even though she knew that he couldn't see it from up there, not at this distance or behind the concealing hood of her robes. Rabe had greeted her this morning with a raised eyebrow and, "Have fun last night?" And for a few moments it had felt almost normal, the kind of conversation that she would have had with her own handmaidens. And then Queen Amidala had swept in, kissing Captain Kenobi goodbye at the door to the dressing room. He had been dressed for the cold weather outside. Padme didn't know where he had gone, though he had been back in time for the reception, joining them at the door just before the Queen had entered. She glanced up at the balcony again, seeing one of the blurred shapes shift as though he was following their passage across the crowded ballroom floor. Having them there, her men, Rabe had called them more than once, and Padme might have denied it before, but she wasn't going to do so anymore, was a relief. She was sure that Alderaanian guards and the renegade Jedi were more than capable of defending Queen Amidala against an attack, but they were all unknown quantities. Anakin and Obi-Wan, she knew. "I've got a bad feeling about this," Anakin said, leaning on the balcony railing as he looked down at the ballroom below. The floor was full of milling politicians in bright colors. Anakin automatically noted Padme with Queen Amidala, though hooded and robed, she was indistinguishable from the other two handmaidens. Anakin could always find Padme in a crowd, though. He didn't need to see her for that. Obi-Wan was pacing a few steps away, his arms crossed over his chest. But at this, he stopped to look at Anakin. "What kind of bad feeling?" Anakin prodded dubiously at it with his fragile hold on the Force, feeling the ache in his mind as the channels used for manipulating it flexed but held without tearing. "Just a bad feeling. I don't know. Nothing specific." Obi-Wan came over to stand beside him, resting his hands on the railing.
"Here?"
"Yes? No. I don't know." Anakin shut his eyes, concentrating on the comforting blur of Obi-Wan's presence rather than the strain of the Force use. "Not here, elsewhere. Elusive." He opened his eyes and let out a huff of frustration. "That's not helpful." "Concentrate on the present, Anakin," Obi-Wan said, maddeningly calm. "Be mindful of the here and now. Yeah, I know." He grinned at Obi-Wan. "I've heard this speech before."
"I've given this speech before,"
Obi-Wan considered.
"Qui-Gon used to give me this speech on a fairly regular basis, come to think of it."
"Runs in the family, I guess." Anakin peered down at the floor, letting instinct and experience guide him. He knew a few of the politicians down there. The Organas, obviously, and Mon Mothma of Chandrila, and the Duchess Satine, not to mention Padme and Queen Amidala. But others he only vaguely recognized from Padme's Senate sessions or various meetings with the Chancellor he had attended. Most were strangers, though he would bet money that Obi-Wan knew all of them by name and reputation, even if they hadn't met personally. Obi-Wan might claim to hate and distrust politicians, but he certainly had to deal with them a lot. His personal reputation in the Senate saw to that. Ahsoka was trailing watchfully behind Captain Kenobi, who to all appearances hadn't left Queen Amidala's side since he had arrived on Alderaan. It was unexpectedly disconcerting to see her there, because as much as Anakin was glad that a Jedi he trusted was that close to Padme, it was also a sharp reminder that she wasn't Ahsoka. Not really. Not his Ahsoka. Ahsoka would never... Well, she had, but not like this. Resignation was one thing. Heresy was another entirely. His gaze flitted across the floor to Luminara Unduli and Barriss Offee, standing at the center of a cluster of wary but interested politicians. Then to Quinlan Vos, who was leaning against a pillar and holding a flute of frothy green liquor in his hand, laughing at something the senator, former senator, from Rendili had said. Even we never had to deal with that.
See anything? Obi-Wan asked.
Anakin shook his head. They were Alderaanian guards posted at regular intervals around the room. The Naboo weren't on duty, since this was, after all, Alderaan. And even if there hadn't been, the presence of 5 Jedi visible on the floor should have been enough to dissuade would-be assassins. Anakin and Obi-Wan, along with more Alderaanian guards, were stationed on the balcony that ran around the second level of the ballroom, protected from the sight of the guests below by a privacy screen, whose hum Anakin barely noticed anymore. Between them and the 3 knights and 2 padawans down below, any assassin who wanted to make a run at Queen Amidala, or anyone else in that room for that matter, wouldn't get more than a few steps before regretting their life choices. Back in their own timeline, 7 Jedi would have been overkill. Even the Chancellor seldom rated a protective detail of more than 2 Jedi, 3 at most. But this wasn't their own timeline, and what seemed frivolous to Anakin wasn't relevant here. Besides, Unduli and Vos weren't there just to protect the Queen. They were there to be looked at and talked to, and for some reason that bothered Anakin almost as much as seeing Ahsoka there with Captain Kenobi. Not to mention seeing Barriss Offee walking around free, which he was really trying not to think about at the moment. "Is the Queen really expecting trouble?" he asked Obi-Wan. "I thought nobody except Queen Brea and Senator Mothma even knew she was coming, just that she was sending a representative. This seems... paranoid."
"There have been attempts on her life before, by all accounts," Obi-Wan said. "A little caution is warranted under those circumstances."
"Yeah, sure, but 7 Jedi?" Anakin said. "We could have been back in the suite making out." He grinned hopefully at Obi-Wan, who rolled his eyes.
"You seem very optimistic about that."
"Why, did you have other plans?" Obi-Wan looked at him long enough that Anakin felt a beat of doubt. Then the Force curled warm around them both, Obi-Wan's amusement twined through it, and he said,
"Well, I haven't gotten any better offers lately."
"Hey!" Anakin said, offended, and caught the wicked edge of Obi-Wan's grin. He set his hip against the balcony railing and crossed his arms over his chest as he said, "That's not what you said last night." Obi-Wan's mouth twisted, but all Anakin could sense from him was amusement. He didn't respond, though, studying the ballroom floor. Anakin sighed and leaned back on the railing, trying to ignore the persistent ache in his mind. It felt as though seeing the Ouroboros again, feeling it, had tugged at one of the old wounds of his burnout. Anakin felt a little as though the possibility of his Force use was hovering on a razor's edge, caught between healing fully and being destroyed forever. "The second we get home, I'm shooting the blasted thing into a sun." Neither he nor Obi-Wan had been comfortable with even Force-blind Padme carrying it around, not fully charged and capable of... the Force alone knew what it was capable of. They had compromised by storing it in a locked drawer in their suite, which none of them were happy with. But there weren't really any better options aside from turning it over to Captain Kenobi or the Jedi. And Anakin was damned if he was giving a Sith artifact to a Grey Jedi, even if that Grey Jedi was Obi-Wan Kenobi. Frowning to himself, Anakin shifted his attention to track the Queen's progress across the floor. Amidala stopped at frequent intervals to speak to the representatives of various systems, moving with the easy, sinuous grace of both a warrior and an experienced politician. She didn't quite move like Padme, and it was distracting enough that Anakin found himself staring, trying to figure out what exactly was different about it. She was pregnant, yeah, but that didn't quite explain it. Anakin was trying to puzzle it out when Ahsoka glanced up and looked directly at him. He could feel himself tensing, even though he knew that she couldn't see him through the privacy shield. After a moment, she looked away, her gaze darting across the crowd. Anakin. Obi-Wan touched his wrist, a light pressure against his metal arm that still made Anakin shiver. He turned automatically towards Obi-Wan, leaning in a little as if drawn by a thread. "I know it's not her," he said. She just looks like her, and moves like her, and feels like her. He shook his head.
"Queen Amidala doesn't bother you that way,"
Obi-Wan said slowly.
"The Queen's nothing like Padme."
Anakin glanced down at the floor again, then looked back at Obi-Wan.
"He's nothing like you either."
Obi-Wan shrugged.
"You're much better looking, for one,"
Anakin added helpfully. Obi-Wan touched a finger to his hairline, self-conscious, and said,
"Well, he's not going gray."
Anakin did a double take, then peered closer. Obi-Wan's gingery hair was just beginning to go silver at the temples, a little in his beard. It was barely noticeable.
"I think it looks nice," he said. "It makes you look dignified."
Obi-Wan rolled his eyes. "And you always said I'd make you go gray before your time," Anakin added helpfully.
"Yes, well, I'm still surprised I haven't gone completely white by the time I turned 30.
"At least you didn't go bald. You don't look good bald." Which Anakin had seen after the Rako Hardeen fiasco last year. Obi-Wan looked about 20 years younger, bald and clean-shaven, and it was too disconcerting for Anakin to be remotely comfortable with until Obi-Wan's hair had grown back. That got him a pained look in response, and Anakin grinned and leaned in.
"Seriously, you're better looking than he is."
"I honestly can't say that the thought ever crossed my mind," Obi-Wan said. He watched Anakin's slow approach without leaning back or stepping away, just added softly,
"We're on duty."
"You heard me when I said 7 Jedi was overkill, right?" Anakin said, and saw Obi-Wan's mouth curve in a smile before Anakin's mouth brushed against his. The kiss was soft, a little shy. Then Obi-Wan deepened it, bringing one hand up to curve around the back of Anakin's neck.
"He was a really good kisser."
Anakin pulled away eventually, dropping his hands to the front of Obi-Wan's trousers.
"I could..." Obi-Wan caught his wrists.
"Not here." Anakin kissed the corner of his mouth, his beard scratching at his lips.
"I can be quick." "I didn't say I wanted to be quick," Obi-Wan said.
Anakin felt heat flush his cheek, saw the edge of Obi-Wan's smile, and felt the warmth of his arousal in the Force. Obi-Wan pulled him in to kiss him again, hot and full of promise, then said,
"We're on duty,"
against his mouth, and stepped back. Anakin hissed his frustration.
"You're a tease," he said.
"You're not the first being to say that," Obi-Wan said dryly. Anakin groaned.
"Not this again," he said.
He glanced down at the ballroom floor in the interest of actually pretending to do his job, but nothing seemed to have changed except for a few positions. The queen was almost directly beneath them, silver glittering in her dark hair. Anakin looked back at Obi-Wan and added, "This was a lot funnier when we weren't, Obi-Wan raised an eyebrow, stepping up beside him and crossing his arms over his chest. Anakin felt the focus of his attention shift in the Force as he spotted the Duchess Satine holding court. There was no other way to describe it. In a corner of the room, surrounded by a group of politicians he half recognized. Barriss Offee had drifted over to the edge of the group and was standing by a column, listening intently. Anakin stared at the back of her hood, fighting back the urge to go down there and drag her out by her hair. It's not her. It's not her. It's not her. At Captain Kenobi's faint gesture, more of a mental nudge than the faint flick of his fingers, Ahsoka peeled off from the Queen's entourage. She stood alone for a few seconds, looking around at the crowded ballroom and trying to decide which way to go, then saw a familiar flash of blue and silver out of the corner of her eye. Barriss was standing near the wall on the eastern side of the ballroom, using a light touch of the Force to keep anyone from noticing her. Ahsoka started to make her way across the room towards her, pausing every now and then to exchange a few words with delegates who recognized her as a Jedi. By now, she had developed a rote response, but it still hurt every time she had to say it. She couldn't say that she cared one way or another about the Republic, because the Republic had always been there. Ahsoka had been born on a Togruta colony world whose mother system, Sheely, had been a long-standing member of the Republic with full representation and voting rights, but she was a Jedi before anything else. She barely even remembered her home world. The Order was all the home she had ever known, and it was the Order... Well, she couldn't talk about the Order to outsiders. Not really. And she definitely couldn't talk about the actual reason she had left. All she could do was recite her stock phrases to the delegates who asked her about them, even though she wasn't entirely sure that she believed them herself. Barriss was standing next to a column, her arms crossed over her chest. Her shoulders were hunched in a little, though it was hard to tell beneath her cloak. She turned her head slightly as Ahsoka came to a stop beside her. "That's Satine Kryze, the Duchess of Mandalore," she said, indicating the woman at the center of the group in front of them. Ahsoka frowned. "I didn't know Mandalore was part of the delegation of 2000. "It's not. The Duchess is here with a personal request for Queen Amidala. She..." Barriss hesitated for a moment, watching the Duchess, who was a tall, light-haired and pale-skinned human woman in a stunning blue and green gown. Ahsoka was a little fascinated by the way she moved her hands when she spoke, though some of the rapid motions made her twitch a little as her predator instincts reacted. Barriss rubbed her thumb over her lower lip, a nervous gesture that Ahsoka had only seen her indulge in once or twice before, then dropped both hands to her sides. "She said that she is going to bring Mandalore over to the Confederacy, but that they're not going to participate in the war." "I don't know that they can do that, really, but the Duchess seems to think that Queen Amidala will allow them to do so." Ahsoka crossed her arms over her chest, leaning back against the column beside Barriss. She saw Duchess Satine's blue eyes cut fast in their direction, noting her arrival, but the woman didn't make any other indication that she had seen them, or make an attempt to draw them into conversation. At least that made a nice change. "I thought Mandalore was in favor of remaining in the Republic," she said slowly. "I saw her speak in front of the Senate once, back when the fighting started a couple of years ago. She said the Senate should be relying on diplomacy to bring the Separatists back into the Republic, that turning to violence would only drive them further away." Barriss frowned at the Duchess for a moment longer. "I didn't hear the beginning, but from what I can tell, the Confederacy offered her something that the Republic refused to, because they think the neutral world shouldn't be talking with the Confederacy at all." "Really?" Ahsoka threw another look at Duchess Satine, wondering what could make someone who had been so virulently anti-secessionist to suddenly switch sides. "I know that the neutral worlds have refused to acknowledge the Senate's trade and travel sanctions." She stopped abruptly, feeling the Force sharpen suddenly. Barriss jerked her head up, feeling it at the same time and looking around for the source. Ahsoka saw Master Luminara and Master Quinlan doing the same, and Captain Kenobi putting his hand on the Queen's arm, pulling her closer to himself. The comlink set into her left vambrace began to beep at the exact same time that Barris's did. They looked at each other, wide-eyed, as the sound echoed through the ballroom. Every comlink in the room had activated at once. The last time Ahsoka had seen that happen had been during the faked execution that had hijacked Queen Amidala's broadcast. The ballroom's holoprojector activated independently, flashing the symbol for the official Republic holonews frequency into the center of the room.
"I have a bad feeling about this," Ahsoka said.
Red flag distribution, red flag distribution, red flag distribution. Override all, override all, override all. Priority Alpha, priority Alpha, priority Alpha.
Holonet Live. Breaking news. Republic forces launch planetary invasion of Naboo. Queen Amidala believed dead. System of Naboo now under Republic control. No official statement yet from Separatist leaders. Supreme Chancellor Dooku to speak.
Red flag distribution, red flag distribution, red flag distribution. Override all, override all, override all. Priority Alpha, priority Alpha, priority Alpha.
A flock of congressional representatives, their retinues, and in a few cases, the leaders of the Confederacy's member systems, was waiting on the landing pad as Congressman Palpatine's diplomatic barge touched down. The ship settled down so gently that Palpatine barely felt it. He was already reaching out with the Force, trying to get a sense of the current mood in the Congress. Upset, certainly. The revival of the Holonet and the Holonews broadcast of the invasion of Naboo had seen to that. Palpatine was more interested in the undercurrent of ambition and calculation running through the various members of the Confederate government. Padme Amidala's death, unconfirmed as it was, left a gap in their ranks that many beings would be vying to fill. The diplomatic barge's ramp lowered, letting in a breath of hot, dry air that made Palpatine frown a little in distaste. Despite the fact that he had lived many years on Coruscant before he had been ousted from the chancellorship, he had been born and raised on Naboo. He detested this kind of climate. At a nearly imperceptible gesture from the clone captain in charge of his security, the members of his personal guard preceded him down the ramp onto the landing platform. Palpatine himself followed after them, with half a dozen more clones behind him. Some of the other delegates might call it paranoia, but he believed in being prepared. After all, the clones were the only beings he knew that he could control absolutely. Well, these clones, at least. As he emerged into the unyielding sunlight of high noon on Raxus, he saw that there were only about a dozen representatives, along with their retinues and bodyguards, waiting for him. A few others hung back in the shade of the colonnades that ran along this side of the Raxus Parliament building, which was being used for this session of the Congress. Those he recognized as supporters of Queen Amidala, Mina Bonteri of Onderon, Mina Teles of Dak, Kin Rob of Taris, Anaconda Far of Rodia, and the rest of their ilk. Palpatine took note of them without appearing to look in their direction. Amidala's close friends posed the greatest threat, and it was likely that they would need to be eliminated. Most of them were from valuable systems that he couldn't afford to alienate, but Palpatine was hardly an amateur. It wouldn't be difficult. "Congressman Palpatine," said Chairman Chichao of Pantora, striding along at the head of the pack. His systems delegate, a small, forgettable woman called Rio Chuchi, was there too, looking as though she would have preferred to be with Bonteri and her allies. "I see you survived this Republic outrage." "I was already off-world when it began, I'm afraid," Palpatine said, entirely truthful. "Pure luck. Her Royal Highness, may her soul rest in peace, was still on planet then. The first I heard was the Holonews report." "Yes, terrible,"
Chairman Cho said, not sounding particularly sincere.
As they made their way towards the building's entrance, several of the other delegates in the group offered their perfunctory condolences. It was all for form. Aside from Rio Chuchi, still trailing along in the chairman's wake, none of them had seen Queen Amidala as anything other than a means to an end. Chuchi herself, as Pandora's official delegate, undoubtedly felt it her responsibility to accompany her sovereign.
"As I see it," the chairman said as they passed out of the driving heat and into the air-conditioned cool of the Parliament building, "Amidala's death leaves us with two major problems. I'm sure that you've already considered one of them, Congressman Palpatine."
"You're referring to the presidency," Palpatine said.
"As that little scug thought she was immortal and never considered making arrangements in the case of her death,
actually, I think you'll find that she did," Palpatine said gently.
He wasn't particularly bothered by the insult. He had certainly called Padme Amidala worse, though seldom more anyone else could hear.
"I made sure of that when the Articles of Confederation were being drafted. In the event that the president is killed or otherwise incapacitated, the office of head of state will automatically fall to the delegate from his or her homeworld until another election can be held, no more than one standard year from the date of their death. That would be me."